Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is that time again this week. Time for you to stop by the Council of Trent. I'm your host, Trent Orne, apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers. And this week we're continuing our discussion about the Kalam cosmological argument. So Kalam, being an Arabic word, means to speak. It comes from an Arabic school of natural theology from the Middle Ages. And this argument attempts to prove the existence of God by showing that the past is or must be finite, which means there is a beginning. And if there is a beginning to the universe, there must be a cause. And the only possible cause of the universe would be God. So that's the Kalam argument. And last week, we talked about the argument as a whole, where it came from, and some common misunderstandings of this argument. And this week, I want to go a little bit deeper into it. And of course, for those of you who are wondering about my personal life, I'm still getting settled down here in beautiful San Diego, California. Love being in the office now. I just had a wonderful chat with Mr. Carlo Broussard about Thomas Aquinas, ipsum esse, per se, essential existence, accidental existence, throwing around jargon with my colleagues. Oh, it's really fun. We like to hit the intellectual gym together, as we call it. So that's great. The only thing I don't like is paying the sunshine tax. There's all kinds of taxes and fees here, and they know that they can get you to pay, because where else are you going to go if you want to live here? So I had to pay this ridiculous extra fee to register my car to pay for Governor Brown's train to nowhere. He wants to build a high-speed train that goes from L.A. to San Francisco that takes longer and costs more per passenger than flying. But that's the state Catholic Answers is located in, the state I live in, the state I have to put up with. But I hope you don't have to put up with me. I hope you're here to enjoy some commentary on our faith, how to defend it, and how to defend the existence of God, and how to explain the Kalam cosmological argument made famous by the Christian philosopher William Lane Craig. Argument's very simple. If you remember from last week, it simply goes like this. Whatever begins to exist must have a cause for its existence. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause for its existence. And as I said last week, you would deduce the nature of that cause. It's something immaterial, eternal, powerful, chose to create a finite universe. And if it has causal abilities, but it's not material, God is really the only candidate that sticks out among possible candidates for cause of the universe. So how do we defend this argument? Well, I will tell you this, that there are a lot of critiques of the argument online. If you search on YouTube or on the internet, lots and lots of atheists try to attack this argument. And I think the reason for that, as I said last week, is that it's a simple argument. It's only two premises and a conclusion. And they see it all the time in debates that William Lane Craig does, so it's just easy pickings, whereas they may not understand as well the other arguments that aren't as popular. So how do we defend the argument, and then how do we respond to objections? So remember, an argument succeeds. These are metaphysical arguments. So in philosophy, these are called deductive arguments. They start from a universal truth, and then they go to a narrow or specific conclusion. That's different than science. Science, you do inductive reasoning. You start from a set of observations. You know, you see this, you see that, and you reason from that a universal truth, but it's always usually probabilistic. I mean, some things seem pretty universal. Like we see the effects of gravity. And so theories about gravity, thermodynamics, electricity, the laws of nature, we assume that they're universal because we've seen them repeated over and over and over and over again. And although that still is an assumption, it's a faith-based assumption, if you will, that scientists make about the universe. But inductive reasoning has the black swan problem. In fact, I know this because I went to Australia last year and I got up close and personal with a black swan. If you'd lived in Europe 200 years ago, you would say all swans are white. But then you go to Australia and your world gets turned upside down. That's inductive reasoning. You look at a few swans, you reason to all the swans. Inductive. Deductive is you start with the universal rule and you go down to the particular case. So here's the classic, the grandfather of deductive arguments. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. therefore Socrates is mortal. If the premises in a deductive argument are true, and there's no fallacies, there's no error in the reasoning, then the conclusion follows not with some certainty, like in an inductive argument, but with 100% certainty, as a beauty of a deductive argument. And those are my favorite arguments for the existence of God. And they've classically been the most popular arguments for the existence of God, or they're deductive. That's what the Kalam argument is. So we have to defend that each of the premises are true. The argument is valid. I mean, atheists will say it's not valid. Oh, let me give you two terms to help you. Valid and sound. An argument is valid if it has no logical errors in it. You know, no errors in the reasoning. A sound argument has no logical errors, and the premises are all true. So that's the difference here. So we want to show in the Kalam argument the premises are true, no errors in the reasoning. So what's the evidence for the different premises? Premise one, whatever begins to exist must have a cause for its existence. Different arguments we can give here. One, we can appeal to common experience that, hey, when we see things come into existence, they need a cause. We always observe that. We can also appeal to metaphysics, that it's just a principle that we assume for reality to make sense is that out of nothing, nothing comes. Something can't come from nothing. When we see something come into existence or we see that something exists, we always ask, where did it come from? You know, if the police break into your home and see $1 million there from the bank, you can't say, oh, it's not the same money. It must have just come into existence from nothing. Sorry, officer, this bag of illicit substances under the seat of my car, it just popped into existence from nothing. Nobody buys that. So there's also another argument that I give for premise one, because a lot of people attack these premises and they say, those are just assumptions. They're just assumptions you're making. You can't prove something can't come from nothing. You're just assuming that. Maybe it can. Well, one, I would say, if you believe in intelligibility and causation, how would something come from nothing? You can't have any causal steps. Any step you would put in the process of how something comes from nothing would prove the nothing is not really nothing. But here's the argument I give for premise one. I call it the argument from atheism. So whatever begins to exist must have a cause for its existence. Things don't come into existence from nothing. So I ask atheists, look, what would it take to prove to you that God exists? And they want a miracle. Well, what kind of miracle would help? Praying, regrowing an amputated limb, miraculous knowledge of things. Every example an atheist gives for something that would prove God exists, do you know what they all have in common? Something from nothing. A limb comes into existence, you pray. Something from nothing. I know the outcome of every sporting event in the next year. That knowledge just came from nothing. If something comes from nothing, then they'll say, yeah, that would convince me God exists. Why? Because they assume something can't come from nothing naturally. They assume that if something came from nothing, or if something appeared without a cause, it has to have a cause. In this case, it would be a divine cause. So you have to affirm premise one, that whatever begins to exist must have a cause for its existence, because if you're an atheist and you're open-minded, and a miracle would convince you, that's because you already agree something can't come from nothing. So I think that makes premise one very strong. What about premise two? The universe began to exist. How would we prove that? Two different ways. One, you could go to science. I think science gives us evidence that strongly points in this direction, but I would be careful not to overstate your case, not to overstate your case and say science has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt the universe began to exist from nothing. I say we have very strong evidence leaning in this direction. Remember, science uses inductive reasoning, not deductive. So the conclusions are always tentative, always a matter of probability. So in my book, Answering Atheism, I go over the scientific evidence, and there's things like the Bohr-Vilenkin-Guth theorem. There's other findings in astrophysics that point towards an ultimate beginning, that even if our universe came from a prior universe before the Big Bang, there are elements of the universe related to what's called space-time geometry that point towards an absolute beginning. But I don't necessarily rely on this as the evidence, and as time has gone on, even since writing Answering Atheism, I want to lean more towards the philosophical evidence, because I like that it has kind of a timeless quality to it, to the evidence. Scientific evidence definitely helps sometimes, absolutely. But I'd be careful because when you start investigating astrophysics, as you can imagine, it can get pretty dense pretty quickly. But it's still extremely fascinating. And William Lane Craig has a colleague named James Sinclair who knows this stuff backwards and forwards. He's got a lot of great writings on it. I'd recommend to check that out. The Craig Sinclair entry in the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology has a large section on the scientific evidence for the beginning of the universe. I definitely recommend that. What I like to offer is a philosophical argument for the finitude of the past, like what St. Bonaventure offered. And I basically put it this way, that the past can't be infinite because that creates contradictions. There's two different ways you can go about this. Craig likes to argue that the past, if it were infinite, that would be an actual infinite. And actually infinite things cannot exist. You could never have an actual infinite number of things because that would create contradictions. So, for example, I mean, infinity is a crazy thing. There's the understatement of this podcast. Infinity is a crazy thing. That which is larger, the series of even numbers or the series of natural numbers, which are all the numbers 1 and greater or 0 and greater? The natural numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, going onwards to infinity, or the even numbers? You would think the natural numbers are bigger, but they're both the same size. They're both infinite. They have infinite members. And so the problem is that in mathematics dealing with the infinite, there are rules. Just like you can't divide by zero, you can't subtract infinite sums from one another. Because you can do math with infinite sets, but you can't do subtraction. It's prohibited. But if you had like an actual infinite number of baseball cards, as Craig says, why couldn't you take the even ones away from the set? So that's one way he argues. My preferred way is to argue that you can't traverse the infinite. So if the past is finite and time goes through every event sequentially, that the past grows day by day, if the past grows sequentially, if time grows in that way, the past, the future becomes the present, becomes the past. Well, more I should say that as the days continue, the past grows, if you will. So time moves in a series. It's built in a sequence. So if time has to move through every previous day in order to get to today, it would never traverse that previous infinite number of days to arrive at today. It wouldn't happen. In my book, Answering Atheism, I use the example of Aunt Mildred's flower shop, that if Aunt Mildred has to count 100 flowers before she opens the flower shop, she'll open the shop. If she has to count 1 million flowers for her inventory before she opens her flower shop, she will finish one day. But suppose Aunt Mildred has an infinite number of flowers. Is she ever going to finish? No, the shop will never open. Much the same way, if the past were infinite, time could not traverse that infinite series of days to arrive at today. It's impossible. So therefore, the past, since time has traversed this distance, every past day has elapsed, has happened. That means there must be a finite number of past days, which means there is a beginning to time and hence a beginning to the universe. So that's the second premise. And then you reach the conclusion. So if the past is finite, there is an ultimate cause for the universe. Now, how might an atheist object to this argument? There's lots and lots of objections. I'll cover the biggest ones that get thrown out to each, because we talked about the general ones last week. And if you haven't heard that one, go to iTunes or Google Play to download, or go to Trenhorn Podcast to get that content and get more premium content if you're a subscriber. So the biggest objection to premise one, whatever begins to exist has a cause for its existence, I call it the quantum physics objection. People will say, well, wait a minute, virtual particles come into existence from nothing. Like scientists have seen little particles pop into existence from nothing. So therefore, something can come from nothing. And that's kind of the principle in Lawrence Krauss's book, A Universe from Nothing. But the problem is, it's not nothing. They are caused. These quantum fields are something. It's an energy field. These little particles pop out, then they go right back in. That's not really how they don't stick around. So that's not really a good way to say where our universe came from. Also, they're not necessarily uncaused. There are other interpretations of quantum physics that say these events are caused. We just don't know the hidden variables that are causing them. So people don't admit that. But more importantly, there's causal activity here. Even if we don't know why it's happening, even if it's indeterminate, you know, the atoms, the quantum vacuum, the particles popping, we can't predict it. Just because we can't predict it, if it seems random, doesn't mean it's without a cause. David Albert is a philosopher and theoretical physicist. This is what he says about these kinds of objections, like what Krauss makes, saying that something can come from nothing because of the quantum vacuum. He says, vacuum states, no less than giraffes or refrigerators or solar systems, are particular arrangements of elementary physical stuff. The fact that particles can pop in and out of existence over time as those quantum fields rearrange themselves is not a whit more mysterious than the fact that fists can pop in and out of existence over time as my fingers rearrange themselves. And none of these poppings in the quantum field, if you look at them aright, amount to anything even remotely in the neighborhood of a creation from nothing. So I don't think that argument works. What about the infinite past? What are some objections people might make to the argument I gave? Well, I gave this talk at a university in Portland, and someone said, well, wait a minute, if you can't traverse the infinite, then what about Zeno's paradox? We traverse the infinite all the time, don't we? Because the distance from you to the door in the room, there's a halfway point, then there's a quarter point, a 1/8 point, a 1/16th, 1/32nd. There's an infinite number of points between you and the door. So you could, if you can't traverse the infinite, you could never walk to a door or walk to a nearby object. And yet you do. Well, the answer is that in that case, you are traversing a potential infinite. Aristotle noted the distinction. Here, the points between you and the door get smaller and smaller and smaller. And plus, they're mathematical points. They don't have physical, discrete existence. Now, if there were an infinite number of bar stools or little step stools, and I had to walk across each one to get to the door, I would never reach the door. That is more like the discrete existence of days or temporal events before today. So the analogy doesn't hold up there. And the argument from infinite, when I had my debate with Dan Barker several years ago, we'll talk about Barker in a second also, he made this argument. He said, well, if the past can't be infinite, how can God, if there can't be an actual infinite, how can God have an infinite number of thoughts in his mind? Well, the answer is God, you know, he'll say, how can God think through an infinite number of things? Well, God is not a super genius. God is not just an immaterial, super cosmic person in the sky. God is infinite being itself. God just simply has no limits. God doesn't think sequentially like we do. So I told Dan in the debate, God doesn't have to get through his infinite thoughts one by one. They don't even exist as fractured thoughts. All knowledge and truth is immediately present to God as one infinite, eternal, undivided whole. Because God is an infinite, eternal, undivided whole. There's no division in God, his being or his essence, only in relations that we see in the Trinity. Subject for another time, of course. We're not going to get into a sidetrack on the Trinity here. So the infinite, in our world, the infinite collections of things, those are impossible. They create contradictions. God, the infinity of God is not like God has an infinite collection of power or wisdom or knowledge or whatever. God's infinity means God is simply without limit. And finally, the fallacies. Some people will say, look, the argument, it's fallacious. There's an error in the reasoning. There's something wrong with the terms. So let me play an example of that. Because usually when these arguments are made, people just don't understand the structure of an argument. This is a clip from Matt Dillahunty. He's from the Atheist Experience, very popular online atheist. People always ask me to debate him, and I say, yeah, definitely, but nobody's set anything up yet. So, you know, maybe one day someone will set it up and we will do that. Here is what he has to say about the Kalam argument and what he thinks is a logical fallacy or error in its reasoning.
So in order to disguise that, they say everything that begins to exist has a cause for its existence. And, you know, as Dan Barker's pointed out, that divides the universe, that divides reality into two categories. things that began to exist and things that did not begin to exist. We have no, I can point to nothing that fits that second category. I'm not aware of anything that did not begin to exist. It may be the case.
What are the two categories again?
Things that began to exist and things that did not begin to exist. So that second category of things that did not begin to exist, first of all, it can't be an empty set. It can't be, there has to be something in that set. Otherwise, it's irrelevant. You don't get, why would you talk about an empty set? The other thing is, God can't be the only thing that's in that empty set. Otherwise, things that did not begin to exist is synonymous with God, which makes the first premise of the argument become all things except God have a cause, which makes it ultimately circular in that case.
Okay. So the idea here is that the Kalam argument is circular. It begs the question. It basically says something either begins to exist or it's God. And the universe began to exist, therefore the universe is not God, and God created the universe. So the idea here is that you illicitly smuggle the idea of God into the first premise when you say there are things that begin to exist, because that implies there are things which never began to exist. But this objection, to put it lightly, is wrong-headed. First, I would ask Matt. He says, I can't imagine something that never began to exist. Okay, well, Matt, let me ask you a question then. The universe as a whole, it either began to exist or it never began to exist. So there's one. So Matt's in the place where he has to admit either the universe did begin to exist at one point from nothing. It truly began to exist, and hence it has a cause, and so the Kalam argument works. Or Matt could say, well, maybe the universe is eternal. And if he thinks, like many some atheists do, the universe is eternal, well, there, the universe could be something that never began to exist. The problem here is that, now Matt is borrowing this objection from Dan Barker, the former pastor turned atheist. I debated him 5 years ago. We're going to debate again in September. He's confusing the difference between meaning and referent, okay? So two different words could have the same referent without having the same meaning. So if I say New York City and the site of the September 11th terrorist attacks, those terms refer to the same thing, but they don't mean the same thing, because you might know what New York City means without knowing, you know, pre-9/11 that it refers to the terrorist attacks. So the idea here is that, yeah, the term that which never began to exist, it's not synonymous with God. It could turn out God is the only thing that never began to exist. Also, Dan and Matt don't understand that if you say that there are things that begin to exist, there's a law of logic called the law of the excluded middle, which says there's either A or not A. Things either begin to exist or they don't begin to exist. And Matt's just wrong. The set of things that never begin to exist could be empty. He says, well, why would you even talk about that? It doesn't make any sense. Well, you can talk about things like that. There are unicorns and things that are not unicorns. The set of unicorns or dragons is empty. It's fictional. Nothing's in there. But they see, you see, if something exists, then it either is or it isn't. So there's no logical fallacy here that the argument does not illicitly smuggle God into the first premise. God's not anywhere in there. It just says whatever begins to exist has a cause. There are things that begin to exist. Maybe there are things that never began to exist. That might be a logical conclusion of the argument, but those things are not in the first premise. They're not essential to it. And so there's no fallacy here. So that we can agree there are things that begin to exist. And if they do begin to exist, they have a cause. So the universe, did it begin to exist or did it never begin to exist? It's a valid question to ask. And the philosophical and scientific evidence points towards the universe beginning to exist. Therefore, it has a cause. Then you would logically deduce the cause of the universe. If it began to exist, the argument starts all over again. Well, what caused that? And so to escape a logical regress, an infinite regress that does not explain anything, you ultimately need something that never began to exist. And atheists do the same thing. they don't usually just have an infinite regress. They agree. So they'll say the Big Bang singularity. They'll say just eternal universes. That, you know, so they'll say either it's been around forever, which has logical problems, as we showed with Aunt Mildred's flower shop, or they'll just say, well, it's the Big Bang singularity or gravity caused this. Right, but what caused that previous thing? Ultimately, the cause of the universe has to be uncaused, immaterial, eternal, because it created all of space, time, matter, and energy. And as we said in last week's episode, only God is able to fit that description. So if you'd like to learn more about how to defend this argument, how to explain it well, different resources, my book, Answering Atheism, I talk about it in a, there's a chapter on the argument, and then I got a whole appendix on objections to it in the back of the book. And the appendices are some of my favorite places in my books because that's where I can kind of let loose and have some geeky fun without bogging down the reader. You know, earlier in the book, if it was too technical, that wouldn't be good to do for the average reader. So the technical kind of dorky stuff I put in the back in the appendices. So Answering Atheism, I have a chapter and an appendix on the Kalam cosmological argument. And just, you know, look up William Lane Craig's articles. David Oderberg also has some good articles on the Kalam cosmological argument you can look up online. But it's a fascinating argument. Do read and learn more. And we'll take a break from it for now. But in the future, I'm going to return to it because we could talk about infinity and math for 25 minutes. And I promise not to make it boring, or at least less boring. And time. There are different theories about time that affect the argument that I would love to get in with all of you. So fortunately, the future may not be actually infinite, but because we have everlasting existence, it's a potentially infinite future ahead of us. In this life, it's finite. But we have a lot of time left, hopefully, God willing, to talk about more of these different subjects. As you can tell, I've hit my philosophy area here. I'm super excited. I hope you are too. We'll return to some of these and other topics in a future podcast. But for now, I hope this has given you some intellectual curiosity to learn about the arguments for our faith, for the existence of God, to learn them, to share them, defend them, and explain them to others so they can come to know the existence of God and, more importantly, have a relationship with the true and living God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, our Creator, Redeemer, Sanctifier, the God who loves us and desires us to be a part of His new covenant family through the Catholic Church. Of course, the Kalam argument doesn't get you to Catholicism all the way, but it gets you started on that journey. And I hope you will continue your journey with me on future podcasts in the Council of Trent. So go to TrentHornPodcast.com, check out those premium episodes, and I hope to hear back from you all next week. So you take care and have a blessed afternoon.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.